And the guy who drives it through.
We had the high notes on the park. It was, that's how we became a great team together, you know. It was just unfortunate we never won anything.
He's in trouble, if he gets. The super sub has done it again. And Motherwell are back in front.
It's not a choice anymore. You know, we're going to have to be much more effective in the transfer market. And everybody in the club knows that now.
Lukovic on the chase, might get there. Handel is with it. Jukovic! Oh wow! Oh wow! Lukas Jukovic!
Thick or thin, no matter what happens, we're privileged to be part of this club.
And here they come again, Rangers stretched, it's Ahmed again, Pushwich committing himself! And he scored! It's 3-0 to Motherwell!
Yeah, obviously, being on the podcast is everything I've dreamed of.
Chance here for Motherwell. This is Pettigrew, outnumbered though, still has it. Chance of a lifetime for Pettigrew, and it is there!
Hello and welcome to the third of our summer special podcasts. Today, Sean Teal joins the guys. Sean, welcome along.
Hi, how are you all?
We'll just start at your arrival at Motherwell Football Club. Obviously, you had a very significant career before then with Bournemouth, Aston Villa, Tranmere Rovers, Preston North End, and also played for a side in Hong Kong, I believe. You arrived at Motherwell in August of 1998 and made your debut under Harry Campman. Firstly, how did Harry sell you in Motherwell Football Club and your first impressions of playing a debut at East Fife?
To be honest, it wasn't Harry that had any involvement in me coming up to Motherwell, really. It was Brian McClare that was the instigator in it all. Obviously Brian had left, Manchester United that summer and come back up to Motherwell. And I think everybody sort of thought that Brian, somewhere along the line, was going to take over the reins. But that sort of never happened. And, so Harry was manager. You know, Harry was a real nice fella. He was just a nice person, probably too nice to be a football manager. You know, but he gave me a lot of respect with my career and my age at the time. And I went up there and really enjoyed myself. And, you know, I'd literally just come back from Hong Kong. I'd been back in the country. When did you say I signed? August? I'd been back in the country about 2 months. So when you come back from Hong Kong at the age I was, you sort of start thinking, well, you know, what's left for me at any decent level in football back in the UK? So to get a chance to come and play in the Scottish Premier League was more than I'd expected. So, you know, I jumped at the chance.
You obviously joined the club at a period of great transition. I always remember the picture of the tractor and the field at Firth Park and the many, many new signings that came in. And Harry Campman's first summer as manager. It was an exciting time, but it was almost a step into the unknown.
It was certainly a step into the unknown because I had no idea what Scottish football was like at that stage. You know, I knew basically nobody at the club apart from Brian, and I only knew Brian vaguely. So sort of jumping the car with two kids and a wife and coming up to Motherwell and camping out in a hotel for 3 months was different. Let's put it that way.
Your introduction to league football was a 2-1 defeat against Rangers at Ibrox. As a Motherwell supporter for many years, a last-minute penalty at Ibrox is something that we've, or against Rangers in general, is something we've grown quite accustomed to. It must have been a real sickening way, though, to begin your league career.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm a bad loser at the best of times. Still to this day, I'm a bad loser. But, yeah, I mean, to go to Rangers and, you know, everybody knows what a force they were at the time and, the players they'd signed. So, yeah, to get beat 2-1 was tough, to say the least.
The team didn't really manage to pick up any form under Harry, and eventually come October, he departed the club. That came after a friendly defeat to Utrecht. I know that it's something that I find hard to get my head around. You hear Man United and Liverpool and teams like that playing mid-season friendly. Celtic do it quite often here. But why were we in Holland in the first place? I can't quite work that one out.
I think because actually it was quite strange because we went to Holland, we camped out, and Utrecht is not that far outside of, or we were staying not that far outside of Amsterdam, but it was under no circumstances were we going out anywhere, and it wasn't going to happen, blah blah blah. And then Harry disappeared back home to Finland after the game, so we ended up in Amsterdam. I don't know if I should take that. Yeah, we ended up in Amsterdam. I mean, more or less the whole squad. We had a night out in Amsterdam. We got beat in the friendly 4-0 as well. We got absolutely tonked in the friendly. We were awful. They were good. But you're right. I mean, our form up until then had been relatively poor. You know, we were struggling, and we'd get the odd result here and the odd result there, but in general, we struggled. We didn't have the finances, the firepower, you know, to win games really, and that was our biggest problem.
There was movement off the field at that time, and John Boyle had wielded the axe on Harry Campman, and then came.
Did that with a few people, didn't he?
We're going to get onto that. I thought we might somehow. But the first game for Billy Davis was a 5-0 defeat at St Johnstone. But then things picked up dramatically with a 1-0 victory over Rangers.
Yeah. Billy sort of came in and as you said, I remember the game at St Johnstone. We were awful on that day as well. And then things started to shift. So, you know, there started to be movement of players and you know, John Spencer came in, Jeb Brannan came in, Tony Thomas came in. You know, bit by bit, pieces of the puzzle started to come in. Then the goalie came in. You know, and slowly but surely, we became stronger as a unit. To the point, you know, apart from your Celtic and your Rangers, you know, we were one of, if not the third strongest team in the league at that stage. You know, we could turn anybody over on our day, and we turned hearts over many a time at that period. But we always, you know, you were always trying to break into that top two, which is, well, until Rangers screwed the whole thing up, was a pretty dumb deal. You were never going to get in there.
You talked about the guys coming in, guys like Jed Brannan, John Spencer, Tony Thomas. There was also a fair bit of players going out at that time, guys that had only arrived in the summer. They didn't even make it to Christmas, some of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite strange. There was a few, and because Harry had brought quite a lot of foreign lads in, from all different areas. We had the keepers at Miko.
Yeah, Miko Cavan.
Yeah, the blonde keeper who you know, was a nice lad, but God, he was in a different planet half the time. you know, and the core of the side basically really was the Scottish lads plus myself and Jamie McGowan, of all people, and Michelle Duisberg at fullback. And, you know, we hung on to games simply because we were quite strong at the back at the time. But we never had that firepower until Spenny came in, and that sort of started to change things a little bit. You know, Jed came in and scored a few goals, and, you know, we just became stronger. And we became much more of a force because we stuck together a lot more. We were quite a tight-knit group at that stage.
Can I just ask, Sean, just in terms of the players who didn't last long at the club, was Holm Kraska a real person? Because he's one of these players that was signed and then people say he became kind of like a mythical figure where nobody really was sure if he was actually real or not.
No, he was. But I think I only saw him once. he was quite a big lad, if I remember rightly. Listen, I'm getting old now. My memory's going. He was quite a big strapping lad, if I remember, but just not cut out for professional football, I suppose, at that level. You know, I mean, there was a few of them at that stage that were brought in and just, you know, you could see straight away they were always going to struggle. You know, and they'd get a little run in the team, then they'd be out, and then you'd never see them again. That happened to a few of them.
It's such a huge contrast, though, isn't it, to guys like Brannan and Spencer, Andy Gorham, guys that have played football at very, very high levels, from obscure foreign players. Was there a feeling that the club were moving towards something bigger than the personnel around the club?
I think originally that was the first thought, that, you know, Mr. Boyle had come in and splashed his cash a bit, and there was rumours about what Spenny was earning and what Jed was earning and what some of the others were earning. You know, so yeah, there was money being thrown at it from his point of view. But he kept it, if you think about it, he kept it to really them four. So Jed, Tony, Spenny and the goalie. We're the only four, really. You know, the rest of us, normal people, our normal wages.
I'll move it on to the following season. And it started in such bizarre circumstances. You remember the 6-5 defeat to Aberdeen, where you had Jim Leighton and Andy Gorham, two of the best goalkeepers in the Scottish national team. Aberdeen coming out 6-5 winners, a crazy game. You got a goal in that as well, but it couldn't have been pleasant as a defender.
No, it wasn't. I mean, the first thing that I remember about that was that I was stripped to the captaincy by Billy without an explanation. It was given to the goalie. And he just sort of expected me to accept that, which didn't go down well in my books. But going on from that, yeah, the game was a real weird game. You could probably play each other, you know, 7 days a week and never get a 6-5 again. It was just one of those days where obviously forwards had a field day and defenders were crap.
Then the following game was a victory at Tannadice, and again you were on target, you were prolific around that time, but it took two attempts at the penalty, didn't it?
Yeah, you see there was all this thing about I'd never missed a penalty in my career, and I hadn't, and I still haven't, because in the record books it goes down that Teal scored, it doesn't say retaken, so no, I've still never missed. But the lads ribbed me for weeks about it, because obviously I had to retake it. That was just, you know, it was always nice to win. We always enjoyed winning as a team, as we hated losing as a team as well. So, to lose 6-5 and then to go to Tannadice, which is always quite a difficult place to go and get anything, really, was good to win.
See, this is a time that we talked about in quite big depth with Kevin Twaddle as well. And he remembers the win at Celtic Park that came shortly after that. Possibly a little more fondly than you do.
Yeah, I lasted 20 minutes, didn't I?
How was that following the game from the dressing room or wherever you chose to watch the remaining stages?
I went and sat with the supporters.
Did you?
Yeah, I found my way up the back, up a back corridor, and ended up with our supporters. It was a ridiculous sending off, if I'm honest, because yes, I'd caught the lad. What was the lad's name that I fouled for the penalty? Young lad, can't remember his name now.
Mark Burchell.
Yeah, but Mark hadn't gone to ground, if you remember. Mark stayed on his feet and had the shot and missed, and then the referee gave the penalty and sent me off. And it was like, well, why did you know, you let him have his shot, he's staying on his feet, so he hasn't even gone down. He's had his shot, so he's completed what he was trying to do, and he didn't miss because I caught him. He missed because he missed. So why then bring it all the way back, apart from it being at Celtic Park, obviously? We'll give him a penalty and let them miss and make fools of themselves again. So, but yes, but I remember the game well. I remember us, and winning was, you know, it was always huge to either go to Ibrox or Celtic Park was always huge. I know what you're going to mention next now. You're going to mention the return game at Fir Park, aren't you?
No, what I was actually going to move on.
Thank goodness for that. because that was 7-1.
Despite some preconceptions, we do have a wee bit of a structure to this at times. I was going to talk about, you mentioned the captaincy.
Yeah.
Andy Gorham, a big high-profile name in Scottish football, but it never seemed while you were here that you were doing anything but a great job as captain. It must have been a real kick where it hurts to be stripped of the captaincy.
It was the start of the crap that went on later, really. It was all linked to the same thing. So, I don't know what you've heard and what you haven't heard, so it's a bit weird. But
that's the thing. It's kind of an opportunity for us to hear, because I must confess, yeah, I don't think we do know. No one really knows the whole story apart from those involved.
So here we go then. So this might take a while. So we finished the previous season, and I'd played quite well. Billy had told me I played quite well, blah, blah, blah. So I'm in the shopping centre at, East Stirling, is it? Am I right? No, not East Stirling. Where's the shopping centre just down the way from Motherwell?
East Kilbride.
East Kilbride, that's the devil. So I'm in the shopping centre. I'm due to fly to LA the next day to my cousins in LA with Carol and the kids. And I get a phone call off Billy Davis. And it's like, hello, big man, how are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. You're going away in the morning, aren't you? Yeah, I'm going to LA, yeah, for a month. Okay, says, listen, just so you know, I've spoke to the chairman. There's a new deal on the table. When you get back, don't worry about it. Go away, have a fantastic holiday. No worries. We'll see you when you get back. Get it signed up and off we go. Great. Great news. Jump on the plane next day thinking, sorted. We know what we're doing. Came back to pre-season, first day back. I thought, I'll go and speak to Billy about this new contract. I better get it sorted. I want to get it tidied up pretty quickly. And he went, Teely, you'll have to go and speak to Pat Nevin. All right, okay. So he goes and finds Pat. Pat's not in. There's a shock. And he wasn't in the next day neither. So when I finally caught up with him like 3 days later, Pat, what's going on? Billy told me to come and see you about my new contract. What new contract? And I'm like, what? So I got a phone call before I went to LA. Blah, blah, blah. Billy told me the chairman's agreed I can have a new deal, to come and speak to you. Don't know anything about a new contract. I'll speak to the chairman and find out. Came back to me next day. Chairman doesn't know anything about new contracts. And I'm like, oh, great, here we go. However, if you wait till about November, let's see how things go. Why November? I don't know. But so, and then I get stripped to the captaincy. And then it's like, something going on. I know there's something going on straight away. I can tell. So I've been in the game too long to be messed about. And I thought, I'll sit with it a bit and see what happens. So I played and I happen to think I'd done okay, you know. Nobody had complained. I hadn't been dropped or anything. And then we get to November and I speak to Pat again and Pat says, the chairman wants to wait till we have the mid-season break in January. Wow. So that's another 2 months. So it gets to mid-season break and we went to Portugal that year. So we go away and they shove me with Tony Thomas. Now, I know Tony really well and I've known Tony a long time. But Tony at that time was having real problems with the club. He wasn't playing because of his knee. So the club were being a bit awkward with him and he was falling out with Billy left, right and centre. So to stick me with him seemed a bit strange in the least. And of course we had our world famous coach Mio had come in by then, didn't we? Mio Armidrag.
Is that his name? Armidrag, Volkopik.
Well, somewhat like I'm a drag anyway. Well, he was a drag, put it that way. So he came in, and he was calling all the shots, and he was the worst coach in the world. He was absolutely unreal. He was getting senior pros to do things that youth kids did, and it was just pathetic. Luckily, I didn't have to do any of that, because as the senior player, I was allowed not to go into them sessions, thank goodness. So all the time we were in Portugal, the 5 days, I think, he was playing up a bit. He was being a bit awkward, Mio, and this, that, and the other. And And if you remember, or you may not, the press had were over there with us, and things would be passed out to the players, like on printed paper, you know, where they got a press release and it'd be printed on a plain piece of paper, and it'd be passed to the lads. And I was passed one, and then it was an interview with Billy saying, and Billy basically just saying, if the big man thinks he's going to get that type of money off this club, he's got another thing coming. Well, I'm looking at it thinking, well, I haven't asked for anything because you've not spoke to me yet. So where's this coming from? Somebody's trying to make it out like I'm being greedy. So when we got back on the Sunday, Derek McGregor phoned me from the
Scottish Daily Record.
No, it was the Daily Record at the time.
All right, okay.
But I've known Derek a long time because Derek was down in Bournemouth when I was at Bournemouth years and years earlier. So I knew I could trust Derek to print what I wanted him to print. So on the Sunday when he phoned me and asked me how I was, I said, well, do you want to print something? Because I've got something you can print. And I basically said what I wanted to say, knowing that, you know, it will probably get a few people's backs up, which obviously it did. But it was based on the fact that it was a pack of lies. The whole contract thing was a pack of lies. It was just, you know, and as I said, I think in my article at the time, you know, as far as we're concerned, we're just a piece of meat. And John Boyle uses us as a piece of meat. So when we're not wanted anymore, we're just discarded. We're like a little toy to him. I got a writ off a solicitor and everything. He was going to sue me for defamation of character and everything. Till calling someone a liar, till you realize that calling someone a liar in the national press is not defamation of character and you can't sue anyone for it. So, but the man's got an ego bigger than his wallet, and he's just, you know, I would never speak to him. I wouldn't even spit on him if he was on fire. Pat Nevin the same. But Billy Davis the same. You know, I've come across Billy since, and he can't even look me in the face, Billy Davis. Mind you, he can't look me in the face anyway. He only measures up to my hips. So.
it sounds horrendously like it was played out in public, a matter that it should have been very much dealt with behind closed doors as well. I suppose, though, looking back with hindsight, it was a sign of things to come in terms of the way that other personnel were treated too late, 2 years later when the club entered administration.
It was John Boyle down to a T, the whole thing. I was the first to go. Then one of the Dutch lads, Rob, can't remember his name.
Rob Mattai.
Yeah, Rob Mattai was thrown out of the club 2 weeks later and told not to speak to the press or you'll get no payoff or something. And then from the, like you say, the club just snowballed into administration and into debt. And because, you know, he had all this, he wanted to be a football club owner, but he had no idea what he was doing. You know, he brought Pat Nevin in. He was just his little bum boy. You know, Pat did what John did. What John said, Pat did. And Pat Nevin's never been any different to this day. You know, he does what he's told. And that's the type of person he is. I've got no time for Pat whatsoever. Like I said, if I bumped into him in the street or in a TV station, I wouldn't even look at him because I've got no time for the man at all. Well, if you call him a man. I don't call any of them men. I think they're all chickens. None of them would face me up at the end of it. You know, and Billy's the same. You know, Billy blatantly told me a lie in that June. Told me something that wasn't true and then backtracked badly and said it was all me. And when push came to shove, he looked after his own job and screw everyone else.
Just to ask then, on reflection, do you feel that it kind of played out just haphazardly, or do you think it was more a sort of concerted effort to actually push out of the club?
I think they wanted me to walk. I think they did it from the, I mean, I wasn't even on great money. You know, I was on the same money, as when I left Tranmere. So I wasn't on any great money. I wasn't on the thousands and thousands a week that I know Spenny and Jed were on. And that wasn't even an issue. I wasn't even bothered about that, to be honest. The money was never the issue. I wanted to keep playing. I wanted to keep playing at the highest level I could. You know, and when you do a new contract, then, you know, you obviously get a small pay rise anyway. That goes without saying. So, but the money was never an issue. I just wanted parity with, you know, what I was worth to the club. And then all of a sudden, of course, this all comes out. And then all of a sudden, John Boyle's saying, I'm too slow, I'm too old, I'm too this in the paper. He never said it until the game. And then it was the Celtic game. He actually pointed out the penalty. Oh yeah, well that he gave a penalty away at Celtic because he was too slow and blah blah blah. And all of a sudden, you know, my career was falling to bits according to John Boyle because John Boyle knew me better than anybody else. You know, so, but that's the way it was. You know, John Boyle forgets the broken eye socket, broken jaw, and shattered cheekbone against Scott Severin at Fir Park. He forgets all about things like that. And playing 3 weeks later with my face still a mess. He forgets all about that because that doesn't count, you see. And that's what really annoyed me because I pulled everything out to make sure I was on that field every week at the age I was at then, which was 36. But they dropped me like a stone. And it was so planned. It was so obvious when you think about it years later. Although I don't think about it very much anymore because you know what, you move on with life, don't you? You know, and I just think, they had it out for me. John Boyle wanted rid of me. Maybe I was too big a voice. You know, maybe, because I wasn't one to say nothing in the changing room. I'd say my piece, whether they liked it or not, and they knew that. But that was encouraged. That was encouraged when I first went there. You know, Harry Campman wanted someone to be strong in the dressing room. So, you know, you can't suddenly want it 1 minute and then tell everyone to shut up the next minute.
It's kind of, I suppose as a supporter, it's hard to hear the way the club was operating at that time. And I think the events of April 2002 made people very well aware of the way that the club were treating people, and whether it was viewed as a necessity or just a terrible act of business, you still seem to be held in a very, very high regard with the Motherwell supporters, despite possibly not holding the fondest memories of the way your final months at the club transpired.
You know what, every club I've ever been to, I've always had a good rapport with supporters. And part of that's because as a professional soccer player, professional footballer, you're very, very fortunate in the job you get. So, and the people that pay your wages at the end of the day are the supporters, whether, maybe not nowadays because the wages are so ridiculous. But at that time, certainly, you know, the money that came through the turnstiles helped pay our wages. So, you know, as respect to the supporters, you've got to remember that. You know, so if someone stops you in the street or while you're doing anything and asks you for an autograph, that's what you're there to do. You're there to give an autograph. You're not there to stick your nose up in the air because you're too big for that now, like they are nowadays. I mean, they're all like Billy Big Bollocks now. They don't want to sign anything. You know, they don't want to speak to the fans. They don't want to sign anything for the fans. They all have their signature, done so that nobody can copy it. They don't sign anything so it can't be sold on because they're scared of image rights and all that garbage. You know, so wherever I've been, I've always had a good relationship with supporters. Managers, different kettle of fish. To be fair, apart from probably three managers, I hated all my managers. Hated them all. I thought they were all two-faced. I thought they were all about them and not about the team and the players. And that was no difference in the end at Motherwell.
I was going to say, Sean, just you mentioned obviously, you know, you didn't go on a few of your managers. Before you were at Motherwell, you were at Tranmere, obviously. And I know there was an ongoing with John Aldridge there. What happened there? How come you
He was another one. He was another one. Same thing, funny enough. I was captain there. He got the job. I signed for Tranmere from Villa for John King, who was manager. John got the sack at the end of the first year, and John King was such a real nice fella. You know, maybe not the best manager in the world, but he took them to four playoff finals in 4 years. So, you know, he was doing something right. And then he got the sack. John Aldridge, being a player, got the job. So the one thing that people don't realise is when you go from being a player to being manager, all of a sudden you realise or you get to know what everybody else is earning. So I was record signing, and still to this day I'm record signing at Tranmere Rovers. and I left Villa to drop a league to go and play at Tranmere. So I was on good money at Tranmere. So he found out what I was on, and it was as though as soon as he found out, he wouldn't even speak to me. He wouldn't look at me. You know, things were done at Tranmere to get me out of the club. Things were done there against my wife to make my wife look bad, and she ends up being banned from the club for doing nothing wrong, and it just got ridiculous. And in the end, I shipped out to Hong Kong to get away from Tranmere. And he couldn't wait to get me out the door. He almost, in fact, I'd be surprised if he didn't throw a party the day I left. Because he had me in with the kids on a Saturday morning, he stripped me of the captaincy, made me turn up for every home game, whether it be a Saturday game or an evening game. I had to drive through to Tranmere. And then to be in the dressing room with my boots and everything ready to go, and then I wouldn't be in the team and I wouldn't be on the bench. And it became such a laugh and such a ridiculous thing to do. And I was supposed to stay and watch the whole game. I used to jump in the car and drive straight back home. I wasn't sitting there to be humiliated by him. You know, so it's just the way it is. You know, you either get on with people or you don't. And, you know, like I said, I wasn't the quietest person in the dressing room. And to this day, I'm not the quietest person. You know, I say my piece, and if people don't like it, hey-ho, get on with life.
You talked about moving on there, and obviously a great deal of time has passed since you left the club. Mm. This season, Motherwell have very much flirted with relegation, only surviving after winning the playoff against Rangers. Was that an opportunity? Did you get an opportunity to see that game, or both the games? Or
no, I've not seen a Motherwell game since the day I left, and that's well, not through. That's not through, apart from you can't get them on the TV down here anymore. It doesn't, you know, we don't get Scottish Premier League football on the TV down here anymore. But I've never been back up to the ground. Which is a bit strange because Alan Marshall, who's safety officer, is a big mate of mine and always has been. But for years, you see, I was barred for years. John Boyle barred me. The day I left, John Boyle barred me from the ground. I was barred from Fir Park, full stop. If I turned up, I wouldn't be let in. So, you know, what was the point? I wasn't going up there I wasn't going to drive 2.5 hours up there to get to the door with a ticket and say, oh, sorry, Sean, you can't come in. Might have been fun if I'd have done it, but I wasn't going to try it.
it sounds like it's a bit of a source of frustration, though, that it's maybe taken so long to get the opportunity to say your piece and maybe kind of fight some of the misconceptions that have been around previously. I think that John Boyle left Motherwell and he was almost kind of forgiven for the administration process because he saw the process out and the club got back on their feet. And I dare say that as supporters, you kind of forget about the guys that were made redundant at the time. You just move on and hope for the future of your club rather than perhaps
of course
focus on the lives that were ruined at the time or affected at the time.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, the club's more important than any of the players anyway, or any of the staff. You know, it's more important that the club survives and carries on and rebuilds at that stage. You know, I mean, I left. I went for a trial to Sweden. That was the first thing I did when they stopped me training. So for 2 weeks I was suspended. That was the official thing at first. But I was suspended without pay, which that just showed how much they even knew what they were doing, because you can't be suspended without pay. You can be suspended or not paid, one of the two. So then they said, you know, we don't want you back. You're not coming back. John Boyle won't let you back in, blah, 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 blah. So I went out to Sweden for a trial, and I got there and it was minus 11. And I thought, what am I doing here? And we stayed in a huge hotel that must have been 300 and odd rooms, and we were the only people in the hotel. It was in the middle of nowhere. And then we had to train. Because it was so hard outside, you couldn't train on the fields or on the pitch or anything. So we had to train indoors. What they forgot to tell me was that it was a 5 mile run to get there, then train and then 5 miles back. Yeah, right. Cause I wanted to run 5 miles at my age, didn't I? I couldn't run 5 miles when I was 17, never mind, nearly 37.
You can use some of that spare space in the hotel.
Yeah, just run around the corridors. Yeah. So that was in, and then they had the audacity to say to me at the end of the trial period of like 3 days that I wasn't tall enough to be a centre half. Yeah, right, okay. So
as you say, you had a fairly substantial career following, even leaving Carlisle, and then I believe you came out of retirement following your retirement and went on to manage.
I never actually retired. Because I left Carlisle and went back to Southport, my hometown club, and played part-time there. And then I stayed there 2 years, so that took me to 38, 39 almost. And then I took over as player manager of a little club called Bursko, which is like a village club that were in the Northern Premier League at the time. And the 1 year I was in charge there, we won the FA Trophy. So... and I retired at, 42, I think I was, when I finally jacked in. So, you know, I was 42. I was still managing at Chorley Football Club. And things had started the last season I was there at 42. I was still playing at the time, but things weren't right. And there was no money in the club. All the beneficiary that was giving all the money out for wages every week had cut it by 2/3. So, you know, what we had wages-wise was ridiculous. We couldn't cope on that. And after 3 games, I quit. I walked away and bought a pub and a restaurant for my sins, I suppose.
So that's what you're doing these days, yeah?
No, damn my heck. I sold that 3 years later. I sold that 3 years later after it fleeced me of about 200 grand in total. No, I lost a fair bit of money in the pub, and it was the wrong time. It was the smoking ban came in, and then, you know, people's money belts tightened up, and I bought it in 2006, sold it 3 years later in 2009 for a small loss, and just went back into doing a bit of all sorts. I went painting and decorating again. I went doing fitting windows, doing this, that, and the other. Played Sunday football, and just really, you know, got out of the football scene really, and just played for a bit of fun, and then started to get a bit of jobs in with media and a bit of coaching here, a bit of coaching there. And I just do things like that now. Just whatever I feel like doing, really.
Can I just ask, Sean, it's more a question, just based on the fact that you were, you know, a particular type of centre-half. I'm just looking at some of the comments on Steelmen Online about yourself. Things like, made of solid oak, was phenomenal to see him up for a challenge header. They don't make defenders like that anymore. Pure granite, a mountain of a centre-half. You said earlier about the fact that, you know, money being ridiculous in football and that kind of thing. Do you ever watch games nowadays and sort of wonder quite what's happened? Because I can imagine, you know, players like yourself would probably be sent off every second game these days.
Yeah, I mean, what do you mean every second game? I wouldn't last 200. Yeah, I mean, I go down to Aston Villa quite a lot. We do a lot of corporate stuff down at Villa Park on match days, so. Probably once a month, maybe twice a month, we'll go down and we'll do meet and greet type things. So, you know, we'll get paid a fee, we'll have a meal, we'll watch the game, and we'll go and shake hands with a load of people and tell a few stories, this, that, and the other type thing. And it's all good fun. So yeah, I sit there and I watch, and I watch people play, and I think, oh my life, how's the referee not seeing that it's a dive? How do the referees miss everything all the time? You know, how's he managed to con the referee yet again? Why doesn't he go and challenge for the ball? I mean, most centre-halves nowadays can't head a ball. You know, but then again, the game's changed completely. So it's all about being a super athlete first and foremost. And then having some ability as well. You know, so I think, you know, for the most of it, you know, managers nowadays are looking for people that can get up and down the field quick. And can run all day, because that makes them a stronger team to start with. And then they throw in a few flair players here and there, and hope they can turn it on and create something. And Villa's been like that for 4 years now. You know, Lambert brought in, you know, a host of less than average young players, who just weren't good enough for the Premier League. You know, I don't know where Paul Lambert, where his focus was at the time, because he was bringing in players that, you know, Yakuba Silla, who was, you know, a young lad from the French second division, who couldn't trap a bag of cement. It was ridiculous. You know, his second touch was a header. You know, just honestly, some of the things that were going on, and I'd watch these players, and I'd have like Gordon Cowan sat next to me, or I might have Ken McNaught sat next to me, or Alan Evans sat next to me, and we'd be looking at each other going, oh my life, what's going on here? What have we signed? What's, you know, what happened to getting the ball on the floor and passing it? You know, and that was synonymous with a bad period of time for Villa as well. Wrong players. And it's all about the player now, and it's all about fitting into a system. And it's got to be, it can't be, you know, someone who goes trying to volley someone over a, you know, the stand every week, which I used to like doing. But, you know. Well, I mean, if you look at someone who tackles nowadays, if they don't win the ball cleanly, and if they do win the ball cleanly, but still carry through and touch the player after they've won the ball, it's now a foul.
Yeah. Well, I think that's actually one of the reasons why the Motherwell fans still kind of hold you in quite high regard, because you're probably, you know, one of only a few sort of blood and guts, old-fashioned centre-halves that are, like, you know, in recent memory, to be honest. I think that's probably the main reason why, you know, when your name comes up on message boards and things like that, you are still held in such high regard.
Well, it's very nice of them to hold me in that regard. You know, I appreciate that, and I've always appreciated, you know, the fans that have always supported me, and that for the most has been, you know, 100% of them. So you'll always have the ones that think I'm a big, dirty old git who just wants to hurt somebody. Well, the truth being, you know what, you're not far wrong, because, you know, I like to win. I love to win the ball, but I love to flatten them as well. You know, there was no better sense of achievement than winning the ball cleanly, but as you follow through, flattening them. Couldn't be better. Because that's what the game is about.
Yeah, we'll try and organise maybe a five-a-side football game with yourself and John Boyle then.
Put Pat Devon and Billy Davis in as well. It'd be like Skittles.
Kevin, I just... Well, I'm not calling you Kevin, that's for sure.
Yeah, don't call me Kevin, no.
Sean,
especially if you're referring to Mr. Twaddle.
I was actually... I was going to point out there that Kevin Twaddle had selected you as part of his all-time 11 of players that he's played with throughout his career. And also to invite yourself to do a similar thing for us in the near future, if you'd be up for that, that'd be fantastic.
Oh, I'll have to think about that one. All-time 11, oh my life. Oh, well, yeah, okay, I'll do it. I don't mind.
Yeah, that sounds great. Just finally, I'd like to finish with thanking you for your time. It's been really interesting, and as I say, I think that the opportunity to speak and maybe clear up some misconceptions hopefully has been good for you, and it will certainly make for a great lesson for the fans. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I agreed really to come on, because I sort of knew from speaking to Alan Marshall at the club that, you know, I don't think a lot of people really ever knew what went on. What was written in the paper was just crap, so... I mean, that was just a cover-up for what was really going on at the time. You know, and I think supporters deserve to know the truth sooner rather than too late. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter now. It's water under the bridge. It's 15 years ago, but, you know, it's still important that people know the truth.
Jay Busta, thanks as always, guys. Busta has been suffering with an ear infection, quieter than usual, but he's on the mend.
Thanks very much. And again, Shawnee, thanks very much for coming on.
Hi, cheers.
You're welcome, lads.
You've been listening to the By the Men MFC podcast. We'll be back next Monday with Richie Foran. Until then, thank you. Goodbye.